You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Andre Bagu. He's talking to me from Trinidad. Andre, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Andre, I know you're going to read some of your poems today, but let's begin with what you're working on at the moment. What's occupying, and I know maybe it's multiple things, but what's occupying your creative world at the moment?
Well, I think that's exactly it. Most writers, I think all writers, are always working on several things at once. Even when you're focusing on just one specific project, there's always something at the back of your mind, some germ or some seed of an idea that's slowly blossoming, or some problem in some other work that you're trying to resolve, that you've stepped away from, that you're looking for some sort of resolution for. And I think right now, what's determining what I work on is one word, deadlines. So I have some poetry commissions for which the deadlines are coming up, and one of them is a project that is being done by the National Trust in the UK and Peepal Tree Press, a British publisher, and it's a project that's all about how the past is reflected in the present. It's called Colonial Countryside, and they've paired writers and poets to various English heritage sites within the UK and asked them to write poems or fiction in response to various houses. And I was chosen for this commission, and I was paired with actually a house that appears in, I don't know if you've seen that Merchant Ivory film, The Remains of the Day.
I have,
Yeah, with Christopher Reeve and Emma Thompson and Anthony Hopkins. And I was actually paired with that house. It turns out that house has a very interesting colonial history, and it has ties to the colonies that are incredibly profound. And so right now I'm really, you know, I did a lot of research. I got into the house. I read up on the background to its owner. And, you know, I'm just fine-tuning a draft for what I think is a really major poem for me in relation to this project, because I think right now that's part of the problem we have. We have this kind of amnesia in which we forget our past and we forget our history and we forget the ways in which we're tied even across borders.
So tell me a little bit more about that house, because I have a vague image of it. It was a gorgeous, giant place, wasn't it?
Definitely. I mean, it's Durham Park, and it's basically not far from Spa. It was very opulent, and its owner, William Blathwaite, he was, in fact, the administrator for the colonies. So he was pretty much a high-ranking civil servant who had oversight for the entire process of how all of the colonies were being administered, which is incredible. And, you know, there are all sorts of ties in the house to that whole history of slavery and then later indentureship. So the house has various relics and artifacts. Some of the materials in the house, such as the stairwells and various textiles and ornaments, actually were gifts from various persons who were in the colonies, who were trying to curry favor with this high-ranking civil servant. It's incredibly alive. The history when you actually go into that space. And I did have to go to the house. I did have to visit the UK and spend some time there in order to write this poem, you know. But it's really incredible and really alive. And it's a very tangible reminder of how history has a direct impact on our present.
And the poem, I imagine, will be discussing that history or referencing that history and that impact?
Yeah, and the poem, no. And then, you see, I did a lot of research, and, you know, as you do when you're a writer, you do quite a lot of research, and I tend to immerse myself in everything, and I kind of get a little obsessed, and I just find out more and more and more and more and more. And you can really go on and on with the process of research, but eventually you have to stop and actually comply to a deadline. And I kind of dove into it, and then I allowed myself to feel my way through the materials, to feel my way through the archive, and to kind of come up with a form that I wanted. And so I chose the form of a litany, which basically tied together that sense of an inventory of items, which was very relevant, I think, to this whole idea of him being a property owner and him being incredibly wealthy on the back of slaves, as well as also connoting this kind of transcendental leap that I was trying to achieve, or I am trying to achieve in the poem. But I don't like to talk too much about works in progress, because then
okay,
I don't want
okay,
to, like,
yeah,
goat mouth it, as you would say in Trinidad, or drinks it.
Right. And I'm going to ask you to read some poems, but what else is?
Yeah, also definitely. Coming up right now in the Caribbean, we have Cari Festa, which is the regional arts festival. So Trinidad and Tobago will be hosting it this year, and it will take place this August, later this month. And for that, I've been asked by the Bocas Lit Fest, the local literary festival here, to administer some workshops and to also participate in readings. Also, there's the Trinidad Tobago Film Festival that's going on, and I've actually been involved in that as well, because one of the things I work on and one of the things I am really strongly interested in is the idea of poems that kind of blur the boundaries of form. So I do a lot of film poetry as well, and I actually have a film poem in the film festival. In the experimental
a film,
film
poem. And what does that mean, a film poem?
Film poem, exactly. Good question. Basically, a film poem is, well, to some extent, all films are kind of poetic in the sense that cinema is concerned with creating a relationship between images within a sequence. And that's kind of what a poem does, line to line, image to image. But a film poem is basically... it's a poem in which, or it's a film in which poetry is the substance of the narrative. So there's no real plot, so to speak. It's more concerned with being an immersive experience, with bringing to life the mood, the textures, the images of the written word, but in a visual form.
So there is words in it. I mean, I asked because I went to an experimental film festival not long ago, a few months ago in New York. It was all very short films from around the world. The films were non-narrative. The films were abstract almost entirely. Often just images that aren't figurative in any way or narrative. And in the end, when they were had a Q&A, they talked. Some people refer to them as visual poems, but I think that's quite different than what you're saying, right? I mean, and it seemed to be a category that was sort of, I'd never heard of before, but you're talking about actually the words are being used. There's letters, well, forms, and words in there.
I think you're right. It's the same, you know, visual poems, film poems. It's basically a poem that is, instead of being on the page, it's on the screen. I think that's probably a better, safer, more open definition. So I would think of there's a famous film, Looking for Langston, by Isaac Julian, for instance. I think that's a great example of a film poem.
Right.
Tony Harrison did one called V. Heathcote Williams, he did one on Cars. Yeah, so I mean, there have been, several, quite a few famous ones, but yeah, I guess that's what's the overall principle. It's just instead of being on the page, it's on the screen.
And so I know there's probably a few other things, and I want to hear some of your poems, but what is the next, what else do you have your hands in?
So I've been trying to also examine longer forms like fiction and also various forms of reportage relating to the arts and culture. But it's all very tenuous, and it has to really be. I need to like finish these things first, and then I'll talk about them.
Okay. So I know you have there's three poems there. What is the first one you're going to read?
The first poem is called "The Body in the River." The body in the river. We cannot know her legendary head. Only a torso left, arms, legs, eve of Frankenstein's labor. The blue barrel floats like baby Moses, born by the Nile. It carries the Empress, naked as paper. What would Botticelli make of this? Venus, torn into dangling limbs that silence water. Silence air, pitch roads silent, Kiskadees silent, dead museum of forensic trees. Mitan, Mitin, mon coeur, Eden. We cannot know her legendary head, crowned now by Sargasso. Sea eyes that swim to heaps of pearls, great anchors, wedges of gold. We cannot know her other shores, where seaweeds make slender patterns, trails of termites in the hot house on the day her destiny becomes clear. No river is more silent than this.
Thank you. Very beautiful, and of course clear what you're talking about, and it seems like it's a specific body of water that you're also referencing.
So this poem is it's based on two things. It's based on, unfortunately, a true story. Trinidad and Tobago has been experiencing a crime wave, and this is something that I struggle as a poet with, because every time you say you're a poet, it kind of feels like an act of defiance because you live in a society in which there are incredibly heinous acts of violence perpetrated against women, against men, against ordinary people going about their business in the street. And, sometimes you wonder whether or not there's a relevance for poetry. And so this poem was it came at a moment when I felt I had an obligation as a poet to reflect and to comment on what is happening in my society. So this is actually based on a true case that remains unsolved, that happened a few years ago. It also draws on a famous poem, the Archaic Torso of Apollo, I believe. If I can just double check that. It also draws on a famous poet poem, The Archaic Torso of Apollo, which is about it's a description of a statue of Apollo that has no head. So that became an interesting prism for me to address this issue.
Very beautiful. So I'd love to hear another poem. What are you reading next?
So next, I'm going to read a poem from my second book of poems, and this poem is called Chacon Street. Chacon Street is a street in the capital of Port of Spain. It was named after one of the Spanish governors of the island. Of course, Trinidad has a very complex history in that we were at first a Spanish colony, then a British colony. Tobago had a separate history, but then at one stage it was linked as one administrative unit with Trinidad. Chacon Street. For those who walk the pavement below, the building is invisible. Small stores are fronts for a hidden chamber where a silver car daily is parked. Invisible are the three floors in this moss hulk where the rooms are knots. Naked men sleep outside by a black iron gate concealing mystery. They know. They all know. Shreds of plastic bags, cardboard sticks, the apparatuses of their deception, will one day revert to the cathedral with its fine stone pillows, and the men will all rise, walk past the mall nobody shops in, past the empty lots the color of rum and piss, the old colonial building and loan society building, and the madder wall oozing puzzling chemistries, and say, this is where joy lives, on the saddest street in the world.
Thank you, Andre. And that also sounds like it has a very specific reference as well. We're talking about a specific geographic area and street even, is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Chacon Street is most people know the streets of Port of Spain very well because it's such a small city, and it's a relatively short street, but it has had, just its name evokes such a rich history. But like many areas of the city, it is representative of a kind of neglect and depression that's fallen on areas of our urban landscape, particularly since the city was attacked in 1990 during an attempted coup attempt. But yeah,
so we have time for one more. I'd love to hear another one. I know you have one more, and I'm not sure what book this is from.
All right, so I'm going to read a new poem. So every few years, I tend to write a sonnet or two. And recently, I've been gardening. And so this poem is called Mealybugs. All they get by chance, and multiply in ignorance. Page white, they grow between branches. They grow. This peacetime upheaval, grow, outbreak of dandruff in cotton tranches. Behold, diamond dew, a mistaken view, till the whole plant is ensnowed fossil. Silver leaves curled like mother's torn hem, Texas sage made fungus, at last transformed from a thing living to a thing possessed. This is how it blooms, like the mushrooms in the savanna after violent rain. This is how it moors to wide open fields, unexplored hills in the distance. Grief.
Thank you. That's a beautiful one. And where was that from? That poem.
So that's actually a new poem that I've recently done.
Thank you so much for that. And thank you for reading today and sharing your time with me. I want to ask you one more thing, which is, what is it that you're reading at the moment?
You know, I've turned to a lot of the work of Thom Gunn, the Anglo-American poet. And, you know, I had to do this because I was asked to write an essay on him recently, and I had always been a fan of his work. But in the course of writing this essay, I really had a kind of a renewed engagement with his work. And I came to appreciate how his writing is so incredibly dynamic. On the one hand, it can be very formal and very rigid in terms of its attention to meter, in terms of its rhyming couplets. It can have a very closed feeling. On the other hand, he tends to take those very formal, traditional forms and applies them to very irreverent subject matter. So, for instance, he has an entire book that's about drugs called Molly. And the book is incredible. But what I've been struck by is how, to some extent, he was arguably hiding his identity and his sexuality. He was gay. Whilst at the same time, he was actually quite open about it. And I've had a new kind of realization with regard to him, because I realized just how he, by co-opting all these very formal kind of forms and traditions, he was kind of saying language is not the property of anyone. He was kind of like Derek Walcott, who wrote epics and sonnets to make a point about the capabilities of colonial subjects. And he was saying, well, I too, as a queer voice, I'm entitled to and worthy of engaging with this very long and ancient tradition. So, yeah, so I've been reading a lot of work by him, his collection, The Passages of Joy, The Sense of Movement, The Man with Night Sweats.
Andre, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.